As we continue our examination of the Michael Vick case, we thought it might be helpful to give our audience some insight into what goes on at a dogfighting match. We were unsuccessful in finding a dogfighting advocate to join us, but we wanted to share this call received by Radio 1 in Baltimore.
I used to fight dogs, right? The way they making it seem right now, it's totally out of order, man. It's totally out of order. Reason being, because a dog fight, they don't call them dog fights. They call them rolling, right? First of all. The second thing is each dog have a weighing category that he has to be in, right? And his rules, just like a regular boxing match. What was messed up is that they not publicizing the white boys that started it. They making it seem like, oh, Michael Vick is this barbaric person for doing it, right?
So what type of dogs you used to fight? Pits?
No, I used to fight American Bulldogs.
Okay. Why'd you get out of it?
Well, I just got tired of it. You know what I mean? Because you lose a lot of money.
Was it here in Baltimore?
No, it was all over. I mean, you could go from New York all the way down to Atlanta to fight.
With us now is Eric Sakish, who spent 19 years as an undercover field investigator for the Humane Society of the United States. Sakish's work has led to the arrest of more than 500 people involved in illegal cockfights and dogfights, as well as to some of the first convictions under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. Sakish currently directs the Humane Society's West Coast Regional Office, and he joins us by telephone from his home in Sacramento, California. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Allison.
I know you've attended some dogfights as part of your work. What was it like to be there? What's it look like and smell like?
The atmosphere is one of paranoia. Actually, the paranoia is so thick, and I'm talking here with respect to the people that are attending the fights, although my fear level was up there too. A lot of the people there see themselves as being part of a highly secretive sort of fraternity, if you will. The preparations that go into putting one of these things together and eluding law enforcement are extraordinary.
What kind of precautions do they take to keep people, well, investigators like yourself, out of there? And how much danger are you in if they identify you?
Well, in answer to the first question, everyone who's involved in these things is well aware that what they're doing is illegal, and that the penalties can be fairly severe, and that there are frequently other crimes involved at the same time. I mean, it's almost invariably we're going to encounter guns, narcotics.
You mean from the people in the room?
Exactly.
How much danger would you be in as an investigator if they looked up and caught you?
Well, if I had been discovered during the period of time that I was doing any of that, I think the outcome would have been something that I'd prefer not to imagine. There are certainly homicides connected to both of these activities around the country. It really just boils down to who's there and how badly they don't want to be caught.
For our listeners that have never seen such a thing, what happens once the dogs are in the ring? How does it actually happen?
Well, the dogs are brought into the arenas from opposite sides after they've been washed. The arena usually consists of a plywood group of walls about 20 feet square with a carpeted floor. There'll be lines indicated in the arena called scratch lines, usually applied with duct tape or spray paint. The dogs will be brought into the pit and faced into the walls, and they'll be held by their handlers. There are two handlers and a referee in the arena with the dogs during the fight. The dogs will be faced on the command of the referee, and at that point, usually if the dogs are barking at all, that's when that would happen, as soon as they see each other. The command to face your dogs is quickly followed by let go or release, and at that point, both handlers release their dogs. The dogs will collide like a couple of freight trains. It's essentially a wrestling match with teeth, where the dogs are literally biting on each other, trying to get a better bite hold on their opponent, and this will go on and on until one of the dogs turns its head and its shoulders away from its opponent. When that happens, the referee will order the dogs be handled as soon as neither one is biting on the other or when they're free of holds. Both handlers will swoop in, pick their dogs up, take them back to their respective corners.
This is not always a fight to the death. It's just a fight until one of the dogs can no longer continue.
Unfortunately, I've not seen a dog actually die in the pit, although we're aware it does happen, and there are plenty of accounts of that happening. I have seen dogs die afterward. Dogs often die from dehydration, blood loss, and shock, and that's because these fights go on for an incredible period of time. On average, about 45 minutes.
How are the dogs treated during the event? I've been reading a lot of things on the internet where people who have been to dog fights claim that they've never seen the dogs tortured or treated inhumanely because that wouldn't make any sense. And they say that the owners often treat their own dogs after the fight since they can't take them to a vet because it's illegal. I mean, but are the dogs treated well?
Well, I think those are, it's incompatible to use the term treated well in connection with the dog fight. They're treated like a money-making machine. And so, obviously, it's to your advantage to try to keep the dog well and in good physical shape. It's not unusual for characters to be injecting their dogs, putting IVs into their dogs right after a fight to try to recover them.
Gambling, of course, is a very big part of this. Did you see a lot of money changing hands at the fights that you attended?
Well, one of the fights that I attended, worked on undercover some years ago in Arkansas, involved over $500,000 on 250 people.
I'm curious because a lot of people have been saying that this sport is a black and Latino sport these days. And I'm wondering, what was the racial makeup of the crowds that you saw at the fights that you attended? And were they mostly in rural areas?
The fights that I attended in an undercover capacity were almost exclusively white, middle-class, blue-collar types of affairs. So the idea that this is limited to any particular culture is a misnomer.
I have been reading that many activists believe that dogfighting is moving from rural areas more into the cities now. Is this true? And if it is, why do you think so?
Well, I think certainly as we see more people moving into rural areas and more housing development starting. We're seeing a lot of these activities take up in suburban areas especially. But street-level dogfighting has been a part of crime-plagued inner-city settings for many years. It used to be Dobermans and German Shepherds that were abused into fighting. Your typical junkyard dog kind of situation, but virtually any city of size, especially where you have gang activity.
You testified at trials involving this, right?
That's correct.
How involved in the sentencing were you? I mean, how much time do people face for this on an average?
It's all over the board, and it depends on the state. One of the longest sentences that we've gotten out here in a case that I worked on personally was 7 years. Although one character in South Carolina has been sentenced to 40 years, there were 10 years added on for some of the booby trap devices that he placed on his property around his dogs, one of which discharged on a surveyor. These were booby traps that involved 12-gauge shotgun shells, and a surveyor tripped one. And this was all designed to keep law enforcement out of his dog area.
Eric Sakish is a former undercover field investigator with the Humane Society of the United States. He now directs the organization's West Coast regional office and joined us by telephone from his home in Sacramento, California. Eric, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Allison.
And thanks again, Allison. Allison Keyes is an NPR correspondent.